Thank you for downloading this podcast from the Forum for Philosophy. Subscribe for weekly discussions of science, culture, politics, and the arts from a philosophical perspective. The Forum is a non-profit organization, and our events are free and open to all. You can support our work via our website and Facebook page.
Good evening, everyone. Many people see themselves as allies, standing alongside members of an oppressed group and joining the struggle for social justice, while themselves not members of the group. Tonight we're going to discuss what being an ally means, and if, when, and why allies are important. We're also going to ask why some attempts at being an ally end in failure, and we're going to consider objections to the very notion of being an ally. I'm Sarah Fine from the Department of Philosophy at King's College London and fellow here at the Forum. And I'm delighted to introduce our wonderful panel for this evening. We have Cara Sofoco, who's a co-founder of feminist organisation Level Up. She previously worked at Some of Us and the New Economics Foundation and was an advisor to Lisa Nandy MP. She also co-founded iStreetWatch.co.uk, to track the rise of racist and xenophobic street harassment following the EU referendum. We have Dawn Foster, who's a Guardian columnist and author of the 2016 book Lean Out, about feminism and structural injustice. She also contributes to the New York Times, the London Review of Books, and Prospect magazine, and is a regular commentator on the BBC and Sky News. And to my left, we have Sridhar Venkatapuram, who is a lecturer in global health and philosophy at King's College London and founding director of the MSc in global health and social justice. He's the author of Health Justice, an argument from the capabilities approach, which was published in 2011, and he's a pioneer of the health and human rights movement. Thanks very much. Okay, so we're going to start with what seems like a simple question, and that is, what is an ally, and indeed, when or why are allies important? And could we start with you, Karis?
Sure. I don't really like the term ally, so I'm not sure if I'm the best person to start with. I think, and I guess everyone will have their own definition. Okay, no one likes the term ally. So I think that the reason, I think part of the problem of why I don't like the word ally is I think it's used by people to make themselves feel good about themselves, number one. This is going to become a long list. and I think the second thing is there's a distancing and an othering inherent in the word ally. So then we get into this. Social justice is the superhero style fight of the goodies against the baddies, and then there are these poor people who are oppressed or marginalized or in some way disadvantaged, and we, the allies, like, this isn't gonna bomb because everyone looks really young. Anyone know what Captain Planet is? So it's this sense of, like, you're superheroes fighting for the disadvantaged. And I think my approach to politics and social justice is much more rooted in the tradition of nothing about us without us. And I think one of the things I find frustrating and depressing about Twitter debates around social justice is even just terms like ally and identity politics. And it's like, so first of all, everyone has an identity. I don't know why I'm the only one with an identity and why when I talk about being a woman or being black or having grown up in social housing, it's identity politics. But when any number of the white guys that write about it for The Guardian or the New York Times sort of write about, oh, identity politics, isn't it terrible? And it's like, so you don't, but you have an identity also. And I think for me, ally comes from that family of words that's a bit jargony. It's not a bad thing. I think it's good to want to campaign with and on behalf of people, but I'm not convinced it's ultimately helpful in social justice or sort of, I don't know, progressive movement, communities. I'm going to hand over to someone now. I think I'm petering out.
Dawn.
Yeah, I completely agree with Karis. I think it's, the key point is that it's very, very jargony, and I only really see it being used in situations where somebody is kind of making themselves feel better about themselves. Mm. You know, like saying I'm an ally to people of colour, etc. Is often used in a kind of, you know, kind of very self-reflective, you know, navel-gazing way. Whereas, you know, you'd hope in society that the default position was that you aren't a racist. Mm. You shouldn't have to, you know, say, I am an ally of people of colour as that kind of term. And I think as well, it kind of de-centres fights around social justice away from the people they affect, away from the people who are mainly organising. And, I mean, just to give an anecdote, when I went to university, I'm older than most people in the room probably, like, started in 2006 and thought I'd get involved in some societies. I was only just kind of, I'd always been quite political, but I was only just coming around to kind of feminism. Before that, I hadn't really thought it kind of affected me very much. And I went to look for a society that could, you know, fit in with that. And the society at Warwick University where I went wasn't called the Warwick Feminist Society. It had been started by a couple of people and called the Warwick Anti-Sexism Society. And I thought that was unusual, went along and was surprised that half of the society executive were men. And when I went along to the first meeting, they were talking about the fact they were selling T-shirts that had the FHM logo on, and underneath said, feminism helps men. Basically, that society went, you know, it seemed to spend more time trying to get men involved in feminism than actually fighting kind of things on campus. So I ended up with two other people trying to get the university to give students maternity leave if they got pregnant, trying to make sure that the campus nursery wasn't just for you know, staff members, it was for students as well, especially mature students, and trying to make a pregnant student's kind of emergency fund that was separate to the normal hardship fund, so that if students got pregnant, they had somewhere to go to. And I had to do that outside of the society because the society spent all of their time, you know, making overtures to men, trying to get them involved, and less time actually fighting kind of sexism on campus. And I found that really problematic, and I think I see that a lot in a lot of the discourse we see around, around this sort of thing now. And I think, you know, people become very, very preoccupied with the concept of being an ally, and it's very, very individualistic. It's all about the individual. It's all about the person that is calling themselves the ally. And I think you can build a movement and involve a lot more people without kind of centering it on individual people and that sort of thing. So basically, completely agree with Karis.
Yeah, I'll bring in Sridhar now. And then I'll come back.
Yeah, no, it's interesting. Thank you very much for including me. It's been an interesting opportunity to think about just what I think about being an ally or the word ally. And I'm also really kind of surprised that, you know, that both of you think that ally is just not a good concept or a term. So there's two ways that I think about it. One is that I think about the importance of collective action and why allies are important in collective action. And I guess one of the primary places where I learned about being an ally is within my own family. And so in terms of my brothers and sister and my parents and the dynamics, and the question was, you know, are we going to help each other accomplish certain things, or, you know, sort of be able to say that something was totally unfair? Are you going to back me up or not? And so there were lots of conversations about, you know, are you going to, you know, if I go and say this, are you going to help me or not? And I think that's the kind of training where it's like, why is it important? And so it raises questions about, even if I don't have any stake in that particular issue, am I going to back him or her up? And I think that that's just one of my training grounds about what it means to support someone in what they're trying to achieve, or to identify something that they feel was unfair and they just want somebody sympathetic or helpful to be able to support them. And I think that this has played out in a more political and also more recently in my own life in lots of different ways. So I've participated in lots of different kinds of I guess you would say, activism, where in order to achieve our goals, there's some where you just do it to make a point and you don't need anything to happen. You just want to make sure that you, this point gets across. So like a kiss-in, for example, you don't need allies for that to happen, right? You just need to do it. But I think
what's a kiss-in?
Oh, have you not ever done a kiss-in where sort of lots of different kinds of couples basically kiss in public in order to claim the space as being accessible to them as much as anybody else, kinds of stuff. So, and so this is particularly important in a homophobic environment where you need to be able to say this space is as ours as ours. But there are more other kinds of sort of activism that requires us achieving certain kinds of ends, and in order to do that, usually around social institutions, it requires lots of different kinds of resources and skills and people at different levels. So you need to be able to build alliances with people who may have similar struggles, who may also want to help you because they see a parallel to something that they've done, or they sort of, people recognize that this is something that they should be supporting to do. So I think being an ally, building alliances are quite fundamental to social change. So I'm really quite interested in to hearing more about why you think allies and allegiances are not useful. But
I quite like that framing of, maybe we're just used to the jargony, but I think allegiances, and I think the family analogy is a great one. So the organization that I co-founded and run, Level Up, is a collective action organization. You can sign up at www.welevelup.org. So it's an organisation for anyone who wants to work together to end sexism in the UK. I guess we call our supporters or followers members, and I think that there's a difference. Let's use the family analogy because I think it's one we're all familiar with. And one that applies to a lot of lots of activism. If you and your siblings are going to band together to take on the injustice of mum and dad. Bedtime, it's too early. We want to do it at 9. And sometimes it's going to be things you care about, and other times it's going to be stuff that you're like, I kind of like broccoli. I don't think we need to have broccoli banned from dinner. But in all of those instances, you're identifying as allies within the family and as siblings. And I think what sometimes I see online, and online activism, which, you know, my organisation does a lot of it, isn't all of activism, but I guess it's the most visible part, and it's the most visible part to most of us. We're all sort of scrolling through Twitter and Facebook. I think often on the internet and on social media, what you see isn't that family analogy of, I have skin in this game, I've got, you know, I'm a member of this family, and I'm not okay with homophobia on my campus or with racism on the streets of the UK, which is, you know, I made a website about that after Brexit with a friend. But it's a sort of, oh, these poor people are suffering, and I, the benevolent person who is not suffering and who does not have an identity, or I, an ally, will help them. And I think that isn't, the word ally doesn't mean that. Not all the time when people are allying together or in allegiance is that that's what's happening. But I think in this sort of niche social media, social justice world, that's what I see, and it's something we really don't want and Level Up. So a great example is we ran two campaigns at the end of last year that I'm incredibly proud of. One was around the Gender Recognition Act, which I think people are probably familiar with, because even though it's quite a niche piece of legislation, people had very strong opinions about it. And we ran a campaign led by trans members of Level Up, who said, on the government consultation, who said, hey, we're trans, we like this bit of legislation, here's why. And then we emailed our members and said, what do you think? We didn't say, here's our position, you must be an ally with trans people. We made a form to hack the consultation. Stonewall had done a really thorough, very geeky form that people like me with short attention spans hadn't got around to filling out. And we made something that took 5 minutes to fill out and said, add your voice. And so for me, and what we found, because, you know, we got a copy of every member response, is that this binary of allies and affected doesn't work. So some people that filled out the consultation agreed with our trans members. Some people were trans members who said, actually, I don't like the legislation. Some people had a trans brother or sister or child, and some of them did like the legislation, and some of them didn't. And I think this, I think where I struggle with ally is this sense that social justice is about goodies and baddies. And I'm not completely convinced about that.
Yeah, no, I agree. I mean, I think that building alliances is really, really important. And, you know, it's the bread and butter of social issues. And I think that the issue, I mean, the issue I have is not with the concept that we have to, that, you know, social activism has to encompass as many people as possible in order to get somewhere. Obviously, it should be led by the people who are most affected. But I think, you know, I think that if you see any form of injustice in terms of structural injustice, in terms of economic and, you know, social injustice within society, or even just like somebody being, you know, attacked or abused in the street, you shouldn't walk past and, you know, and leave that happen. If you see an injustice in society, you should do everything that you have the power to do to combat that. I think the issue I have is with individualising it and making being an ally part of your identity itself, because that kind of, I think that it kind of moves away from activism and instead looks more at kind of individual conceptions of self. So often, you know, just to take the example of the anti-sexism society that couldn't use feminism because it was too exclusionary a term, etc. What it often led to was people who considered themselves allies of feminism and allies of women, who would then often behave in ways that were quite sexist or quite abusive towards some women, and they weren't very reflective about their own experiences. They decided they were an ally, and therefore, therefore they couldn't see, you know, they weren't self-critical, and a lot of criticism that was levelled at them for the fact that they would behave in, you know, sexist ways, or the fact that they were abusive to people, to women they were in, you know, romantic relationships with, weren't fully kind of looked at, because they had taken being an ally to be part of their identity. And I think often it can be quite performative, and I think that instead we should, you know, move away from using it as a kind of, kind of identity sort of jargon term, and instead look at the behaviour. So you should build alliances. You should seek to help people in any kind of ways that you have power for. You know, so if you are a kind of public figure or an academic or, you know, you have a load of cash, etc. There are lots of different ways you can help people. But I think kind of just publicising the fact that you are an ally of trans people doesn't do a huge amount, whereas actual activism, helping people and centering the people who are affected in social justice, is a much better way than kind of wallowing in this kind of self-reflexive sort of terminology.
Okay, I think it's really interesting, the discussion so far, because it seems like we've got a problem here with the way in which people use the notion of an ally. But do we have a problem with the very idea? Because in some sense, it seems like you're both saying, well, it's perfectly legitimate. In fact, it seems to be required for certain movements to centre the people that they're about. And that itself draws some sort of distinction between those that are centred and those that shouldn't be. So maybe we need another word, but isn't there something going on here that there's a sort of, there's the primary and the secondary subjects in this kind of thing?
My university days are coming back now. I'm not very good at philosophy. I don't have a problem with the word. I guess I have a problem with how it's used. And I think, Dawn, you really, it's this sense of almost like it's a pin badge now. Like, and everyone has badges on it. So, I mean, it's going to become clear that I'm pretty old and like not very with it on social media, but it's like a label people are wearing now. And I think that performative notion of I'm a hashtag ally, I'm hashtag remain, I'm hashtag, and I think, you know, these, for those of us that care deeply, passionately, and very much have skin in the game on these issues. For those of us who, you know, want to see a massive redistribution of wealth and power around the world within our own, within this country, I mean, we're talking about huge structural injustice and economic systems, political systems, cultural systems, and systems don't change by saying I'm an ally, I'm a good person. And I think that's what I struggle with. I mean, so case study of one, I'm mixed race, dual heritage. My mum is white, my dad is black, he's from Ghana, he came over as a refugee. My parents split up when I was two. So I was raised by and among white people. So, I mean, no offence. For those listening, it's quite a white audience. White people who love me, my amazing Welsh grandparents who were incredibly racist when I think, is that fair? Hopefully my mum won't listen to this, who were very racist until they had two beautiful mixed-race grandchildren, at which point they became a lot less racist. You know, would still use the term coloured people. They were also Tories, so they would never have had any truck with words like ally. But I mean, I think I grew up in that complexity of people, white people that love you can also be racist or say racist things. And so I think there's just some knee-jerk kind of impulsive, like almost just gut reaction and kind of gag reflex when someone says, I am an ally. And you're like, cool, what does that mean? Because actually this stuff is lived. And I think Level Up, you know, we're a feminist organization, we're open to everyone, we're a feminist organization, we're not for men or women or any particular gender. Everyone, in my opinion, can be a feminist. And maybe it's a luxury of campaigning on an issue that is so cross-cutting and impacts on all of us. What does it mean to be a feminist ally? I'm not really interested in a man coming and saying, well, I'm an ally and I gave you £10, although please do donate. Always looking for money. But I am interested in, like, how do you live your politics? Do you invite the young junior woman that's just started at work to speak in a meeting because you've noticed she's just taking notes and feels nervous? Do you split childcare with your partner? Or do you have a conversation about childcare with your partner rather than defaulting to the person that has the baby looking after them? And I think this stuff, for those of us that really care about big systemic change, that stuff is more important than the words. But then I would say that because I find philosophy stressful.
I'm just going to bring Sridhar in. Sorry. And then I'll open the floor to the audience.
Yeah, just quickly, it's really interesting to hear these comments. I guess the couple of things that stand out to me is, one is that it seems to be like there's clearly a group of people that are just not good at being allies. and that's one kind of problem, but that doesn't necessarily mean that that the concept of ally is bad, or it's incoherent, or it doesn't make sense. I think that, so that's one issue, and we can talk about whether, like, what's a good and a bad way of being an ally. I think that's one thing. The second thing is that, for me, this idea about identity is really interesting because I grew up in lots of different countries, but I also travel quite a lot. And this, and I see social inequalities of all different kinds. So it's not just race, class, gender, and sexuality and age. Sometimes it's geography, sometimes it's ethnicity, sometimes it's tribe. And so, and sometimes I'm really incredibly powerful in one location and not so much in another location. And so it's always really interesting for me to see where, standing where in the world and what kind of position I have in relation to different kinds of groups and people. And so when somebody's sort of making being an ally as part of their identity as a permanent, I guess I'm not, I think that seems to be a very particular place in a particular time where somebody can do that. But I think we should all start thinking much more globally about what's happening in the world and start thinking about, you know, how do we not only sort of do act locally, but we also need to be considering, you know, what is our sort of relationship to other people and other places that we can't see, but nearly, maybe because we have so much capacity for action, and what is, you know, what is our role as potential ally for their struggle and stuff like that. So I think that there is not only to be able to say to someone, you're not being a good ally, but for us, I think we have a lot more, no matter what activism we're doing or what we're not doing, there's a lot more for us to even think about in a global picture. How can we be better allies for lots of other people as well? So that would be the two things.
Okay, so much to think about. I'm going to open to you guys now. We're going to go on to think about why some attempts at being an ally fail. But in the meantime, does anybody have questions about what we've heard so far? If you do, raise your hand.
Thank you. I'm not sure this is relevant, so please interrupt me if it isn't. I think an interesting subject to also be discussing is pseudo-allies. So you have the conservatives who ally themselves with the working class, and in actual fact, they don't give a damn about them and want to see them at best completely wiped out, and at worst, I mean at best, live in poverty forever, and at worst, completely wiped out. And like, we also got the people's vote, where you get a lot of rich people saying, oh, we believe in democracy and your right to vote, we're allies with you lot, England. Well, in actual fact, they didn't, these same people are saying Jeremy Corbyn should never be allowed to be part of the Labour Party, who was there on a people's vote of democracy within a... So that'd be interesting, you know, the pseudo-ally. I mean, this is something that's corrupted conversation and intellect and dialogue.
Yeah.
And all sorts of classes of England.
Yeah, thank you. No, sorry, that's great.
Thank you.
And there was another question. Could you raise your hand? Yeah, over there.
With regards to change, or at least like legislative change, the issue is almost always going to be the fact that the people that are experiencing oppression, that are being activist about it and like trying to change legislature to improve their experience of life and all of that, that those aren't going to be the people that are in like the executives that are making the laws. And therefore, in order for those laws to be made, people that aren't part of the group being oppressed need to support that cause, at least to an extent, in order to just say I and pass that law. And so is that a type of ally or not? And if so, does that not mean that allies are inherent and absolutely necessary for any positive, at least legal, change?
Okay, fantastic. Thanks. Well, I'll put those questions back to our panel. The question about pseudo-allies and the question about don't we need allies for legislative change because, you know, sometimes the people in power are the ones that we need to do things. Can I start with you?
I agree. I think the point on pseudo-allies is essentially what me and Karis were getting at, which is I think one of the reasons why focusing on ally as a term is often very unhelpful is the fact that it kind of reduces people down to good people and bad people. And actually, people are a lot more complex than that. You know, people can behave in different ways in different settings. They can... and also kind of, you know, like the feminist movement, kind of anti-racist movements, all sorts of movements are equally complex. There are lots of disagreements about how we should achieve certain aims or what the aim should be. And so I think that reducing someone down to an ally is basically a way for them to say, well, I'm a good person. And that kind of that terminology and that kind of framing necessitates a kind of abdication of kind of self-criticism and kind of, you know, self-policing of your behaviour. So I think that, you know, I think that using that terminology and using it as a term of identity is an abdication of responsibility, so it's quite unhelpful in that way. You know, I think that the point about legislation is really, really key to what you were saying earlier about the fact that we need to build alliances because, you know, I think that there are lots of different ways that we can achieve a better standard of living, a better standard of, you know, economic justice and, you know, fully get to the place where everybody has the human rights they deserve. And it's not just legislation, there are lots and lots of different things that you can do to kind of improve people's day-to-day life. But when it comes to legislation, one of the things that you need to do is to kind of move the Overton window, so move the public opinion away from, you know, what it has been traditionally towards a situation where the legislation you need is going to get through Parliament. And you can do that through lobbying, and you know, you need to build alliances, and you need a lot of people from all different backgrounds to lobby their MPs and get MPs, you know, looking at these things. So yeah, you need the alliances there. I just think that focusing on an individual to get them to subscribe is often a bit of a waste of time. So I think that you need the alliances, because you need a critical mass of people who can ensure that the Overton window of public opinion is shifting. So I think that having allies is really, really key there. I just think me and Gareth are unconvinced that, you know, the terminology for individuals is not necessarily helpful.
Do you want to comment?
Yeah, I think they were both great questions. Mm. I think they were both relevant questions, just to your point. I don't think I have much to add to Dawn's point about pseudo-allies. I'm conscious I came in critiquing jargon, so I don't want to encourage more jargon. I think maybe where I'm ending up, because, you know, I like to change my mind in the middle of a panel, is I think where I'm ending up is, does anyone watch Game of Thrones? So I think what I like, there's a guy there like, of course I watch it, am I an idiot? I'm sure many people listening also watch Game of Thrones. We're all looking forward to the final series. So I think what I like about that and my understanding of politics, which may show what cynic I am, is that there are allegiances in Game of Thrones, but everyone is self-interested and no one is really hiding that. I haven't watched it in a while, but it's pretty clear everyone's in it for themselves, every family, every dynasty. And not to say that no one is capable of altruism or that people don't act, you know, to better others, but I think that understanding allegiances in that family model, that Game of Thrones model, rather than I am an ally, it is something innate in my character. I will help those that are helpless, I think, which is the connotations I have, which is maybe about who I follow on Twitter rather than how most people are using the word, which is worth saying. To your point, for question, I enjoyed it. I think I went to a conference recently, stay with me, where people talked a lot. It was for the women's movement, whatever that is. I guess I'm part of it. And someone talked a lot about, well, we must have people with lived experience in the room. We must have the people with the lived experience. And I spent the whole time thinking, what does that, so I get your point, and I know from having worked in Westminster that it's not super diverse in the House of Commons. It's getting better. House of Lords is quite diverse, actually, for those that are interested. But it's not a big range of people. They tended to go to the same universities and in some cases the same schools. And there isn't a huge diversity of political opinion within that, although again, I think that's changing and polarizing. But all of those people have lived experience. It's just from a pretty narrow walk of life. So I think what we shouldn't do is get into the situation of there are people who are marginalized and then there are those that save them. There are people who have lived experience. I mean, the great example is something like disability or mental health. Like, all of us know someone who has experienced depression, and probably all of us have a friend or a family member who has a disability. And so what we have to do is get out of that mode of thinking of there are these poor people who have tough lives, and then there are the people that save them. And that's why I think Game of Thrones is a bit more of a useful sense of we should all be forming allegiances, but organising around our collective or individual self-interest, and not some notion of, being a good person or being a helper.
That's really sad that you think Game of Thrones is the way that we should think about
it. Sorry, I'm a real cynic.
So I just wanted to... So this idea of a pseudo-ally, I think, is fairly clear. I think that people form short-term, self-interested relationships of various different kinds in order to achieve what they can for whatever reason. And so I don't think that's sort of really convenient. But I really like this last comment. And what came to mind is that, so in global health, And when you think about health policy and think about something just so simple as, like, you know, child education or child vaccinations, and you want to achieve this thing, what you're going to have to do, and what most people do, and if you actually do it right, is that they sort of map out all the different, who's going to be against it, who's going to be for it, who's neutral, what do we have to do in order to get enough votes for this kind of stuff. So I think that, you know, in that kind of situation, we use this idea of who's pro, who's the ally, who's going to be able to come. So I don't think that that's controversial. I mean, I think that is what it is that when it comes to vote, will they be on our side or not? And we can count them in. And that, I think, is an ally. I just wanted to build on that, which is that it's not that's the confusing bit. It's the long-term struggle that's the confusing bit. It's not, will they vote yes today? It's, will they vote yes consistently over the long term? And this is the thing about, so when I was in graduate school, one of my favorite classes was negotiation class. I don't know if anyone's taken them. I highly recommend you do this. it's a fantastic class about, you know, when you're negotiating one-on-one, when you're negotiating on one issue, when you're negotiating with multiple parties, with multiple issues, and you build up to these complicated things. And there's a lot of theory and framework about how we make sure that everybody tries to get as much as possible, and how do we do that? But what sort of negotiation theory failed at, and I think maybe it's moved on from there, is that people who are have to negotiate like that constantly over the long term, and there isn't a way for us to think about how we live amongst each other and with each other and constantly do this not just once, but we have to do this repeatedly. And what does it mean for us to be supportive and also ask for support in a variety of different places over the long term. So I think that's the more difficult part that I don't have any answers for is, what do we want or expect from people who we think should be our allies, not just once, but over the long term? Mm-hmm. And if we are going to be allies, not just once, but over the long term, what is it that is expected of us, and what should we do or not do? I think that's, for me, an uncertainty about what's going on.
I'm sort of tempted to be really uncompromising and truculent now and see how your negotiation skills pan out.
I feel like they're quite good. You just keep sliding in with the reason. We're just like, it's this, and he's like, oh, this, global perspective, help. And you're like,
Right, well, I'm going to move us on to this question of why some attempts at being an ally fail. And I know we've sort of problematized the very idea of being an ally, but I'm still interested in that potential tension between the notion that, for example, the feminist movement should be foregrounding certain people and certain voices and sort of educating people that you shouldn't always be stepping in and telling us what you think when you're not part of the group that's supposed to be foregrounded here. So could we kind of think a little bit about why some attempts at being an ally fail that talk to that point? I'll start with Dawn.
Yeah. I think one of the issues is that often, for instance, to look at sexism, often people don't understand that you can do sexist things and not be a sexist. I think people kind of bracket themselves into these identities. So you're either a racist or you're not a racist. And actually, you need to look more at kind of your everyday behaviour and your everyday thought patterns, etc. You know, like the whole Liam Neeson thing where, you know, he said, I did this terrible thing and I shouldn't have. And there was a lot of discussion about... I mean, what a lot of my friends found frustrating was that the discussion was about whether or not Liam Neeson was racist. Mm. When my friend said they would rather the discussion was about where that action came from, it was very clear that action was a racist action, it was a racist response. And they wanted to see more discussion about where that kind of response came from, what the reaction should be. Whereas a lot of the discussion was, you know, simply like, is Liam Neeson racist or is he not? Was it, And so I think that often, if, for instance, you kind of try and engage somebody critically and say, you have you have behaved in this way, it's problematic, it's sexist. Mm. Often people take it very personally and react very badly. And I think if for you being an ally and that terminology is very important to you, it means that often you're not very open to the criticism. So I think often it can fail when you try and bracket people, when you buy into these kind of binaries of identity and that sort of thing. So often that can fail because people tend to react very badly. I mean, you know, sometimes if I have a discussion with a friend and I say, you did this and it really, really annoyed me, sometimes friends, you know, will respond, I'm really sorry, I'm sorry that, you know, I behaved thoughtlessly, I won't do it in future, and they'll be reflexive. Other times, you know, you'll bring something up and they respond very badly. They shut down. They see any criticism as a personal attack and refuse to kind of look at their behaviour. So I think that kind of buying into the binaries and the idea that you are either a racist or not a racist and accepting the fact that your behaviour is up for criticism and has, you know, you have to have a situation where you can discuss this.
Where does it fail? Was that the question?
Yeah.
I think it can fail in lots and lots of different ways. So for me, the question now about allies and social justice is about lots of different kinds of difference and working across difference. And so what I mean by that is that, so, you know, we've got great inequality, we've got racial inequality, we've got gender inequality, we've got global inequality. There's so many different kinds of things that I think that, you know, working across difference is really going to be important and is important. And what I think it doesn't work or where it fails, there's like many, many different ways that it fails. One is that I think just sort of people hijacking the movement, because in well-intentioned terms, but I think people might think that because they have the capacity to achieve something faster, better, that they should be the ones who be driving it. And I think a lot of social justice movements are as much about building community and teaching ourselves skills and empowering people as much as they are in achieving the goal. And so one of the ways is that I think people just sort of say, no, the goal is to, you know, achieve this. And so that's one, I think, important way of that sort of not working. You know, I've recently trying to figure out whether I failed in my attempt to be an ally, which is that, I was in Brazil working, or sort of went to work with sort of indigenous populations in the Amazon and working on their health issues. And the idea was that we were going to do a community consultation on the health issues that were important to them. So here I am, I fly into Manaus. And I was thinking as a philosopher, God, this is going to be so amazing because we're going to be talking about all these different kinds of ethical dilemmas, prevention or cure, gender inequalities, And so after this two-day community consultation, it just became clear that the most important thing to them was gasoline. They just want gasoline to come down the river so they can go to the hospital. They wanted to be treated respectfully at the hospital, and they felt that their sort of medical knowledge and practice was not being respected. And so I had to sort of think about, well, those aren't the biggest problems that you're facing, right? Like, my thing was like, actually, you are about to like face this enormous problem around climate deforestation, the political party that's coming into power, but I could help you with so much in terms of international relationships and resources. Do I push that forward, or do we help you with getting more gasoline so that you can go to the clinic?
And we're sort of gasolina. But that's the nub of being an ally, right?
Yeah.
You come and said, but no, it's not the gas, it's this. And so then the question, whether you fail as an ally, do we even like that framing? More binaries, is whether you then say, No,
but that, I didn't.
So that's
the thing, is that it's a really big question, because you know, look, you know, my ethical position is that I think that I should do at a scale of what I'm capable of, right? So my capacity gives me a certain obligation to act. Like you said, if you're walking by somebody and you can do something, you should, right? And I think that that's right. But it's not just do something. But if you can actually do something significant, then you should be doing that rather than sort of doing the little thing when you are capable of doing the big thing. So here was that thing where I was like, but, you know, but we could do this sort of really significant sort of thing. And I'm not quite sure whether I did it right. So I think that that's, I know that I shouldn't have dominated the conversation, which I didn't. But I'm also not sure whether I did the right thing by not sort of pushing the group to say, actually, you know, you should also be thinking about doing this and what we do. And so that, to me, is an unknown. I don't know what the right thing is there.
Can I make a tiny point before I want to hear from Karis?
Yeah.
Just, you know, really, really liked her point and about kind of conversations and domination and that sort of thing. And just like one anecdote, I was... got into an online conversation with a kind of somebody who considers himself a feminist ally, and he was talking on Facebook saying, you know, saying just for some reason he just decided to, you know, write a status update saying that he found it so disheartening how, you know, how many young women felt the need to wear so much makeup, and it was just really, really, you know, it really kind of got him down that women felt they had to do this, and, you know, it was all the patriarchy and these poor, kind of poor women. And it just, I read it and it annoyed me on multiple levels. I was like, A, have you asked any of these women why they wear makeup? You know, and he had decided that they felt the need, they felt they had to. And, you know, I'm a woman, I really enjoy wearing makeup, I like it. You know, I like painting and drawing as well, and for me, it's kind of part of self-expression. I really enjoy putting it on. I enjoy wearing it. Also, you know, for my job, I have to wear it a lot. I'm on television a lot. But also, I mean, I'm also a woman with a disability, and so often I feel terrible, but still have to carry on working. And for me, being able to wear makeup every day means that I look the same every day, pretty much. And you know, so that enables me to feel a lot better about the fact that day to day, based on kind of how my disabilities are that day, I can feel terrible or I can feel great, but I will look the same. And for the most part, that means that people, you know, people don't treat me differently as a result. And he just fully dominated the conversation. He hadn't spoken to any people. He had just sat there and just thought, I'm an ally, I'm, you know. And but in an ideal world, none of these women would wear makeup. They'd be free of the shackles of lipstick, etc. So, you know, I found that really, really irritating. And I think, you know, it's very, very key. Like, when it goes wrong is when allies dominate the conversation. They take the kind of key kind of ideological tenets and then apply them in a certain way without actually still centering the people who are at the heart of the movement.
Thank you.
Oh gosh, now both my examples have been knocked out of my head, because I'm like, yeah, makeup, I want to talk about that. But I think this is interesting. I was going to do a here's a bad example of being an ally, but I'm actually going to talk about, so I think the thing that I'm interested in, I think there's a basic thing that maybe does need to be said that I think you were alluding to, Sarah, which is it would be a bit funny if a feminist event about childcare only had 24-year-old men with no kids on the panel. Like, I think it would be a bit funny because if none of them had any kids or any childcare concerns, that would feel a bit off. And I guess maybe that's where the idea of centering, like certain people being centered, comes from. There are some nodding for those listening. So I think that's maybe there's a basic thing to be said, which is the anti-racism movement can't just be white people, and, you know, feminist organizations can't just all be run by men. So, you know, there are three staff members at Level Up, we're all women. That does feel important, although anyone can apply for a job and anyone can apply to be on our board. We're about to grow our board. But it does feel important that the feminist movement is led by women. I guess I think that the moment we're in now, which to me is a politically quite scary moment and a very polarizing moment, is one where those of us that can hold the complexity of there being grey areas need to start doing it. So a great example would be our biggest campaign of last year on media reporting around domestic violence. So one of our spokespeople, so it was a campaign around two women are killed every week in the UK by a current or former partner, two women every week. If you want to understand why feminism is still important and why I run the organisation that I do, it's because we lose two women every week to a current or former partner. We will lose two women this week. Statistically speaking, one in four people in this room, one in four people listening, will have personal experience of domestic violence. And two of the four spokespeople we used for that campaign were men, Luke and Ryan Hart. Follow them on Twitter. Their mum was killed by their dad. So kind of traditional, I don't know which wave, probably the wave my mum was in, second or wave feminism would say, and my mum was a radical feminist, it will not shock you to hear, a socialist feminist, she would tell me to say. You know, men weren't always allowed in consciousness-raising groups, women that had sons weren't allowed to bring them into certain spaces. And maybe that was right then, but I don't believe it's right now. I think that Luke and Ryan Hart were powerful voices and powerful advocates. And honestly, they are better feminists than me. They have got some deep knowledge of bell hooks and things. Like, you know, that, so I think we do need to move a bit beyond this sense of, well, men can't be involved because it's feminism. And so maybe that's a bit too much. So I think definitely it's not feminism if it's just loads of men talking over women and like dominating. But then also I do think modern feminism, modern social justice movements do need to have room for the fact that a lot of us experience these things, and sometimes the most effective spokesperson on domestic violence is a man whose mum was killed by his dad, who can say, when I read an article saying that my dad was a good guy, like, that wasn't all right. And we won that campaign, so I would say that my approach was right.
My thought was, well, is there just too much hand-wringing then? Is it that,
oh my God, yes.
You know, is it too much worrying about what we know and what we don't know? Because, you know, in philosophy, for example, one of the things that a lot of people are thinking about at the moment is this idea of standpoint theory, that some people who occupy a particular standpoint will have access to certain forms of knowledge and may have some kind of like privileged form of knowledge on the basis of seeing what, you know, the injustices around them, because, for example, they're disadvantaged in particular kinds of ways. So you could be socially disadvantaged, and that can come with some sort of epistemic privilege. So, for instance, the way in which women can see sexism, the way in which people can see, the way in which, you know, a person of colour might see that this is a racist society because they experience it. So, so I think one of the potential worries that comes from that is that people who don't have, sorry to use the words, lived experience, don't have access to those kinds of knowledge, and so have to be very careful about intervening on certain questions. So do you think, well, no, there's too much hand-wringing. Look, you can get this understanding, you have to listen, but don't think that there's any kind of clear distinction between this or that group, this or that standpoint.
Yeah, I definitely think there is far too much hand-wringing, and one of the reasons I really like Caris's organisation is they just get on and get things done. And I think often, you know, part of this comes from the jargon, part of it comes from how much discussion there is about who is an ally, who is a good person, who is a bad person. And I think that one of the worst aspects of social media is the fact that people spend so much time kind of tearing down people who are part of the same social justice movements. It's the idea that there is a perfect campaigner, there is a perfect feminist, anti-racist, you know, gay rights campaigner, etc. And people are very complex, people are very flawed, people are also trying very hard. And I think often there is a tendency, because if you spend a lot of time criticising other people, people assume that the person who is doling out the criticism is a very, you know, is a good person. By attacking somebody who is notionally on your side, often, you know, you end up with some kind of social cachet that says that the only reason you are doing this is because you yourself are beyond reproach. So I think that there is too much hand-wringing, and I think that one of the issues is the way that social media is set up. But I don't want to just fully criticise social media. I think the fact as well is that social media can really, really help us with campaigning. Mm. It can really help us kind of get on with things. It can help us connect with people. And when I wrote Lean Out, one of the things that I looked at was the fact that bedroom tax campaigners, who were predominantly middle-aged women, because they were the people affected, they were the people who lived in social housing, had their kids moved out, now had a spare room, and were having the benefits cut by it. They got together often online, on Facebook, on local kind of community groups, and forged alliances, made themselves more powerful together, and got on with it, and started occupying council offices. You know, they weren't professional campaigners, they hadn't kind of been involved in like the anarchist movement or anything, but they themselves just kind of were put in a situation that put them in poverty and imperiled their kind of their living standards and their ability to stay in their home, and they got together through social media and just did what they had to do to stop the council from, you know, cutting their benefits.
Okay. Yeah, so I'd like to come in on two things. One is that I'd like to disagree with both of you.
On
one thing, which is that I think, you know, we make, and I agree with you, that it's really important in social justice movements that people that are actually the people that are negatively being affected by a predicament should be self-empowered, learning how to act and learning how to mobilize and achieve their goals. So the issue for me is that from a variety of different places in the world, but also even in this country, it's very clear that certain groups are so powerless that we can't expect them to, we can't sort of be in that kind of secondary position you were talking about. So children, for example, I think is a really important example where you want to give them agency, but you also recognize that the skills or the rational reasoning. People who are severely ill, I think, is another group that may not have the ability to self-advocate or collective action that's really important. And so I can sort of give you these other examples. So I think that we have to sort of not be so sort of saying, you know, people, you know, there's a hard and fast rule about how this should happen. I think that in those kinds of other situations, we do need to think about how, even though we are not the people that are being affected, there's something about their capacity, their resources, their skills, their reasoning, whatever that might be, that requires us to be much more active in their struggle than as sort of a secondary sort of intervening thing. I guess that would be my sort of pushback on this sort of thing, is that I think we need to not forget that there's people that are so powerless that they actually do require advocates that are much more active in their struggle.
Yeah. I'm really enjoying this. I mean, often I feel like I'm going through the motions in panels, but I'm really, really enjoying the conversation. It's great.
Yeah. Also, I think there's an interesting... Okay, I think maybe Dawn and I come from a sort of more a politics where everything is contested. So the bedroom tax is a great example. And I think maybe something that I'm now reflecting as you're, you know, with your interesting insights is that, does anyone think malaria should exist? Probably not. So then you're starting from a point of, okay, so how do we eradicate this like awful, you know, my father has had malaria multiple times. Like, how do we get rid of this thing that is killing people and is bad? And I think maybe this is, you know, the lies of the Game of Thrones analogy. I've been more involved in the kind of campaigning where there are people shouting very loudly that what you want isn't okay, and maybe you shouldn't even be allowed to be advocating for it. But I think you're right. To your point, there are a lot of things where that isn't the scenario and where it's not Game of Thrones fight to the death. And I'm agreeing with you, basically.
So
I'm trying to concede.
Yeah, yeah. So what I'd like to add on that is that, you know, you have it in a way easier than the other people who say that they agree that malaria should be eradicated, but actually when you start doing it, they have other kinds of priorities, right? Mm. So it's actually, I think, one of the most difficult thing about philosophy and why I do it, but also why I'm frustrated, is that it's not that you actually disagree in the yes-no kind of way. You disagree on a slightly sort of bit, like we both want to get to the same place, but we agree fundamentally, disagree fundamentally on how to get there. And that tends to be more pernicious than yes, no kind of the thing. Can I just make one more?
Yeah, please.
I just remembered one of the other things is that, you know, it's very interesting that we haven't used the word solidarity at all so far. And one of the things is that you two seem to be much more on the Facebook, Twitter activism bit, which I think is really interesting because I guess ally in some way brings or sets up this idea that an individual is the ally. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering to what extent this whole sort of public space that's now dominated by Twitter and Facebook, where it's individuals behind it rather than groups, is sort of shaping the conversation about what we're doing. And I think that for me, I think we need to think much more about, as I said, working across group sort of differences and how do we organize it. And how do we change the word ally, not just about individuals, but like groups being allies as opposed to individuals? And how do we get that public space back to groups rather than particular individuals sort of being good or not? You have this face, like...
I was just going to say, well, this is a perfect moment to actually think about exactly that. So to think about where do we go from here? How do we foster these communities of solidarity and, you know, sometimes resistance, given the kind of period that we find ourselves in, do we want to do away with this concept of ally? Is that the best way forward? Or do we want to think about it more collectively? Or do we want to unite it with, you know, deeper thoughts about structural injustice? So what do you think? You know, what is the path?
Well, I think that individuals have a great amount of agency. I do. In different... Mm-hmm. places in the world, you have more agency. You as an individual, if you travel to different places, you will just have more agency in some places and not so much in other. But I also think that you as part of a group is also, you know, another kind of place. So I do think that there is a role for us to play in both those things. In our daily lives, it's more of an individual thing. And I think that this makes, you know, we spend a lot of time at work. And it's really, I think for me, really... come home to me about how important relationships at work are, and if you don't feel like you're part of sort of a network that's supportive and a communitarian, then you have to think about, like, am I being an ally to people who are not being treated fairly, or is someone being an ally or not, and all these kinds of stuff. But then, you know, sort of we also have to think about in our community and as part of groups and how do we build stuff. So I do think that, you know, for me, ally brings up more this, like, what kind of relationships are you having with people in sort of different kinds of socially unjust sort of relationships? Like, that's what the question, are you an ally, are you a good an ally, raises for me.
Okay, I think I know what I think now.
Perfect.
Had a bit
towards
of a, like, galaxy brain meme where I was like, oh my god, these questions are too big, I have no idea what I want to say, but now I do. Social change, politics, whatever you want to call it, it's a team sport. Mm-hmm. So you need to be on a team if you want to make change. My view is ally is not a team. So, like, view this as a verb, view this as an action, but team ally doesn't exist, and if it does, I don't want to be on that team. It's the people that want to wear a pin badge and they don't want to roll up their sleeves and make change. So yes, pick a team, pick a tribe, hashtag your Twitter profile, or, you know, put a Vote Labour or Vote Tory poster in your window. I increasingly believe that online, offline binary also doesn't exist. So I talk a lot about the internet because, you know, I think we live a lot of our lives online. That's a whole other podcast. But ally doesn't really mean anything. So be a feminist or a conservative or pro-Brexit or anti-Brexit and ally with people and listen to people that know more about an issue than you do. If you don't have any kids and a mum is talking about childcare, listen. But beyond that, the opinion I formed, which is pretty much the opinion I came in with, but I've got more nuance to it now, thanks to everyone on the panel and the smart questions, is ally isn't a team. You can't organise around being an ally very effectively. So that's my view. Feel free to, you know,
no,
disagree.
That's brilliant. Thank you. Dawn?
No, I just completely agree with Karis. I mean, I really like the you know, I really, really liked her phrase, like, social justice is a team sport. And, you know, the problem I came in with is that, I mean, I think it seems a relatively recent thing that people are self-identifying as allies. And essentially, you're trying to, you know, like, saying, oh, I'm an ally of people of colour. It's like, well done, you're not a racist. But, you know, I think solidarity is key. It's, you know, very, very important to me. And, I, you know, I think building solidarity, you can be a comrade instead of an ally. And I'd be happy with that. I think the kind of individualised self, kind of self-identification worries me a lot because it looks at kind of individualism and it kind of smacks of Thatcherism to me when what I want is more solidarity. What I want is bigger movements that encompass more people. Mm. People work together and focus less on themselves and kind of what they can get out of it and more about what we can do to make the world that we live in right now better within our lifetime for everybody who needs it.
Mm, very inspiring.
Very inspiring.
Anybody want to come in at this stage and ask our panel some final questions before we wrap up?
Or disagree. You're allowed to
disagree. Okay, we've got a question over here. Can we wait for the microphone?
Thank you. It's not really so much a question, but something that's been sort of coming into my mind throughout the evening, and that was the thought that during the Second World War, there was a lot of speak of the Allies. I guess it was a very collective phenomenon and also, of course, comprised of individuals.
Thank you. Yeah, okay, we've got a question at the back.
Yeah, so you've been talking a lot about how, like, social justice is a team sport, which totally makes sense. But my question is sort of, obviously, in some movements, like in feminist movements, you have sort of this rift between black feminists and white feminists about, like, you know, when black feminists bring up some structural issues of feminism, they might get some blowback from it, you know, like, in a more general sense. So what I'm asking, my question is sort of like, how do you balance the need between achieving certain short-term ends by using those allies who are nominally part of the broader feminist movement versus addressing sort of the more philosophical rifts in the movement that have to do with intersectional problems like, you know, gender and race and gender and, you know, other problems like that.
Mm. Yeah, great questions. So we've got the issue about, you know, oh, allies in the Second World War, are there parallels?
I thought that was a good analogy, by the way. You're on my team Game of Thrones.
And then, you know, what happens when there's disharmony in the team and disharmony for good reason?
Can I jump in?
Yes, please.
So, thanks very much for that question. Mm-hmm. So I think that that's probably one of the, for me, that's one of the most difficult philosophical problems as well as a tactical strategic problem. And that's kind of what I was talking about in terms of differences. How do we cross these differences? So there was a big article, I think it was in the New York Times 2 days ago, about wealthy African Americans and their role in fighting social injustice in the U.S. at present. So the idea was that there's now a significant number of super wealthy African Americans, hedge fund company, tech company people, that they've actually set up a political action committee which can fund campaigns. And so what was interesting is that they're essentially saying, we want to play the game that's being played by other groups who are getting their policies through, so we're going to join the game. But the interesting thing was is that the question was, what's their policy on poverty, right? Mm. And, you know, whether they're going to get the tax breaks if they invest in the poor black neighborhoods and all stuff. So there was this sort of weird sort of thing where they had this dual interest of, like, we want to keep making money, and we also... So I just didn't quite understand what their agenda is going to be and what that's going to be about. But in that case, it seems like somebody who's not black but committed to poverty alleviation would be a better ally than the rich black person who's actually going to be more concerned with how far are we going to go along before I actually want to support the, you know, sort of tax breaks and tax policies. And I think this is one of the things that is, I'm glad that in a way we are all now comfortable with, like, you know, a woman in the White House working for the president may not be the best advocate for women's rights, or an African American in the White House may not be the right or the best person. So that kind of complexity is fantastic, because 20 years ago, we wouldn't have been able to say that publicly, right? We wouldn't have been able to say that. But now I think most people recognize you need more than biological similarities to, you know, sort of be able to assume that people are going to have the same kind of political, philosophical, or ideological commitments, right? And so, but now the question is, you know, what you actually said is that sort of you have, you know, different kinds of feminists. You also have feminists from the developing world who are now seeing both black feminists and white feminists in rich countries as being in sort of in a different place than they are, right? So how do we negotiate those kinds of things? And I think that that's the work that we have ahead of us.
I disagreed with so much of that. I'm so excited. Yeah. okay, so this, I think even the framing of your question there, right? Oh, it's like white feminists and black feminists are fighting, I think speaks to your point that we're talking about perspectives and lenses, right? Mm. And there's a nuance perhaps that you as, I don't know if you're going to be super woke now, I don't know if you identify as a man. I'm going to assume you're a man and say that I think there's a nuance there that maybe was lost to you and it, you read it as white women versus black women, what's going on there? Seems like a mess. And that would be one summary of some intersectional debates. And I think to your point as well, I really reacted and was interested. Can I finish? Because I'm going to disagree with all the men. To this sense of, oh, well, rich black people are like helping with racial justice, but are they the right allies? And so I think that's where, having grown up in a working class community and having grown up black, mixed race, I would say both, that stuff just isn't that hard to me. And I do sometimes feel like these debates are very kind of middle class of like, well, are the rich black people the right allies for the poor black people? It's like, well, we'll be the judge of that. But also anyone that grew up without any money or grew up in communities that have solidarity, which in my opinion are working class communities, knows that actually when you're just trying to get by, you don't give a fuck about that stuff. Mm. And I think that that is the meaning of a tribe or a community, that Beyonce gives to Black Lives Matter. Everyone had a go at her, so eventually someone made it public. But of course she gives to it, because of course she cares about police brutality. And if you get it and you have skin in the game, you also don't have time to explain that to people, because people are dying, women are dying. So I'm 6'2", for those who can't see me standing up. My two younger brothers are taller than me. They live in London. They experience racism. Social mobility that we've experienced from going to university or whatever doesn't count for anything when my brother gets pulled over by a police officer. And so like that solidarity is understood on a gut and like blood level. And so it's not really for us to explain to you how does that add up when some of those people are wealthy and not. And I think if you're part of a diaspora, I think it's easier to understand. So I don't know if anyone's part of the West African diaspora, holla! But we have... It's all the same WhatsApp content being sent by various West African aunties and dads, but like that's what I think, and this is the best thing I've ever tweeted, so I'll just keep talking about it until more people agree with it. If you want to understand 2019 or 2020, watch Crazy Rich Asians and watch Black Panther and stop reading long reads about Brexit. Like, pop culture is so much more relevant in a lot of these conversations. These are two films that grossed so much money, were made with and by, like, basically two of the most geopolitically important diasporas in the world, which is the black community and the East Asian community. Apologies if I'm not using the right terms. But if you understand, like, if you watch those films, which are both exceptional pieces of cinema, if you look how much money they made, if you look how much they meant to the communities that they were made for, then you're going to understand a lot more about being an ally and campaigning and organizing than worrying about, oh, the white women and the black women are disagreeing, or why do the rich black people care about the poor black people? Like, people who are of those communities get it, and if you don't get it, that's cool. Like, you don't have to. Wow.
Yeah, completely agree. When I wrote Lean Out, it was partly because I found myself really, really frustrated with the conversations about feminism in the media. Mm-hmm. So feminist activism, just on the ground, I was totally fine with. Most of it was around housing and around austerity, and the fact that when I wrote Lean Out, 80% of cuts affected women, and now it's 90%. So it's gotten worse. Austerity falls really, really heavily on women. So I wrote Lean Out because I felt that there wasn't enough discussion about the fact that economics and the economy that we live in is sexist. It kills women. It hurts children. It like causes no end of pain to disabled people and people of colour. And I agree with Karis. Like, most people don't spend a lot of time talking about the fact that there are conflicts within movements. People I know don't have time to you know discuss the fact that for 2 years a lot of kind of upper middle class white women in the media spent all of their time saying they didn't understand intersectionality. Most people I know didn't care. They were just like, carry on talking, we'll carry on campaigning. And so I think often these splits are given a lot more kind of attention than they need, and also most people just get on with it. They know what they want to do in the feminist movement. They know that they want to, you know, like Sisters Uncut, want to highlight the fact that domestic violence is losing loads of money and it's killing women and it's going to ruin lives and jeopardise, you know, so much social well-being. So people just get on with it. I think people will zone in on conflict as a way of trying to undermine a movement, but the people involved in the movement just get on with it, carry on, and win their battles every day.
Thank you. Okay, you got some fiery disagreement there.
No, I think that's great. I don't. You know, I guess this isn't. You know, so I'm trying to think about what would be. I think that there are some really difficult issues. So, for example, in women's health, there is a big struggle in development right now about what do we do because all this global funding is being cut. And feminists are having to choose between which health issues. Mm-hmm. And that's what I was talking about, is that there is a lot of... And this isn't a way to undermine the movement. This is like a real struggle and a real issue. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's in every movement, right? Mm-hmm. So we're not just one identity people. We're lots of different things. Yeah. And how do we, you know, sort of manage and how do we work across those so that we can actually... move forward.
I agree, and I think that's why the term ally is interesting to discuss, and I find it practically rarely very useful, because once you get into the meat of anything, it is horse trading. It is, you can't have, I'm not Theresa May, I'm not going to talk about magic money trees, but this stuff is contested. It's not easy. If it was easy, there would be no racism, there would be no poverty, all diseases would be cured. There are trade-offs. But I think it's in understanding that we all wear lots of these hats. And so sometimes we're an ally, sometimes we're the person with privilege, sometimes we're the one having to listen and say, really, gasoline, that's your thing. And sometimes we're the one trying to convince someone that they should have a bag for life and not just keep getting plastic bags. Mm-hmm. I'm the one that keeps getting plastic bags. I'm sorry, guys. I'm bad on climate stuff. I'm really bad.
Dawn, do you want to have a final word of the evening?
Inspire us.
I guess I just really enjoyed the conversation. Mm. I think that the main takeaway for me is that the term ally for individuals is not helpful, as Karis said. But I agree with everybody that what is helpful is building alliances, building solidarity, and getting a critical mass around people. Mm. So I like the fact that we can focus more on groups, we can focus more on kind of personal alliances, but also kind of political and ideological alliances. So I think it's building a critical mass, solidarity, kind of getting your comrades together and moving the Overton window of public opinion towards what we're trying to battle for in our movements.
Well, I can't do any better than that beautiful summary. Thank you so much to our panel for a really nuanced and fascinating discussion tonight.
And thank you, Sarah, for sharing.
Thank you, Sarah. That's so lovely.